This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
So, Carol Masser, Tim Stenovec, we are live here at the U.S. Open in Flushing Meadows, just outside Manhattan. It's packed with athletes, their coaches, fans, tourists, and Tim, lots of corporations as sponsors and as spectators.
Yeah, that includes tapping into $10,000 courtside seats and some special new VIP access. Writing about this on the Bloomberg Terminal is Bloomberg News senior reporter Gillian Tan. She is joining us this afternoon. Gillian, let's talk a little bit about what you found in your reporting. Who's paying, who's ponying up $10,000 per seat? What's different about this year versus other years?
Yeah, so I guess, as you can see from the story, like courtside seats are flying, and mostly corporate buyers are the ones who are jumping in, and they're the ones with big entertainment budgets, big, deep pockets. And they're ponying up in part because the suites were sold out, and so the USTA came up with an idea of packaging courtside seats with sort of meeting spaces, dining room access, and then player meet and greets, photos with the trophies, things like that.
It's to me like having gone to a concert with an all-access like pass, and you get to see the rehearsal, you get to meet the artist, you go behind, up on stage. That's what it feels like.
It does feel like that. And like I just saw some friends here. Yeah. They swung by the set, and they said, not a bad day at work, right? And I'm like, I agree. This is not a bad day at work. But we're still working.
Correct.
It doesn't seem necessarily like the people who are taking advantage of this stuff, Gillian, are they actually getting any work done? Or are they just kind of like drinking and eating and watching tennis and, connecting with one another?
You know what? I was talking about this with someone the other day. It's sort of the work before the work, right? It's the relationships, if they're lawyers, if they're bankers, if they're private equity folks. It's solidifying the relationships. A law firm might pay $100,000 to take 8 clients and 2 of their own partners to this little specific box. They can meet with them beforehand, get them shrimp cocktail delivered to their seat so they don't have to even get up. But then down the road, whoever they're taking might just give them $1 million fee, and already that has returned that so quickly. So is it work? This is the fun part of work, I guess.
Well, Gillian, I'm going to go back to kind of what Tim said. I just assumed all of this was going on already. So what is it that the USTA kind of tapped in to that maybe they hadn't been before? Because I know you talked with Kirsten Coriel like we did yesterday live on air, and she's definitely in the thick of all of this when it comes to these relationships. So what is it that they maybe weren't kind of tapping into before on the corporate side of things?
I think it's more that they're tapping in to them by giving them more experiences, right? So anecdotally, I know of someone that hit with Andy Roddick on Arthur Ashe last year. Like, I think that was part of maybe a JP Morgan sort of sponsorship thing. But it's more that they're elevating these experiences for sponsors that have a lot of money to spend with them, but, you know, trying to give them more than, like, any other fan could possibly obtain.
Can I just say, I also feel like going over the top on the corporate side of things, I feel like that was really toned down post-financial crisis, and I feel like we're seeing it in full swing again.
Yeah, absolutely. The other point that was interesting, obviously, the USTA wasn't able to tell me all the corporates that are snapping up these hot seats, but they did mention some new sectors, like cryptocurrency companies are among those who are spending. So as well as, you know, big spending returning post-GFC, it's also, you know, companies that are prospering that otherwise may not have.
Okay, we just talked about the jobs report.
Yep.
And the strength in the U.S. economy. And Carol, you mentioned this a lot yesterday. You look around here and you're saying, there's no recession happening. And look, full disclosure, and, like, you know, to be fair,
yeah,
this is the highest end of the income spectrum that you
right.
have shelling out, you know, for tickets, especially at this year's U.S. Open. But, Jillian, what does this tell you and what the U.S. Open has with, when it comes to pricing power in terms of the U.S. economy right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. They have a demand-based, like, dynamic pricing system. So right when they launch tickets, they try and keep them affordable, accessible in like the $35 to $50 range. But very quickly, as demand sort of floods in, I guess we're seeing that, you know, middle-income America is doing it.
You know, I try to get Jillian back in the last few seconds that we have with her. $140 is what I paid on Ticketmaster today for a resale of a grounds pass today.
Was it normally go for?
You know? I have no idea. And it's not like an old school ticket where it would have a price printed out, right? It's the dynamic pricing that Jillian's referring to.
Dynamic pricing.
But I waited until a few hours before this thing started today.
So did it go down?
It went down, yeah.
It did. Hey, Jillian, we just got about 20, 25 seconds. You love tennis. We were hoping you were going to be here. What are you looking forward to, just quickly?
I do. I'm looking forward to seeing Farina tonight. She's taking on an Aussie, Ila Tomljanovic, and also looking forward to seeing another Aussie, Nick Kyrgios, in action.
All right. Are you headed this way later on?
Tonight, yeah. Tonight. I'll be there.
All right.
Okay, we'll see you here then.
Enjoy. And we really enjoyed your story. Jillian Tan, senior reporter at Bloomberg News, on the phone here in New York City.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
The new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, it is out on newsstands on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. In the finance section, you'll find a story about something Tim and I were just talking about. And this is about ESG and its crown. It is slipping and how it's kind of mostly one group's fault.
Yeah, here with the details on her story is Bloomberg News senior market reporter and the co-anchor of ETF
IQ. She's not here.
She's on the phone.
Maybe we'll talk to her.
She's on the phone in New Jersey. Are you working today, Katie?
Come on, Katie.
Are you actually working today?
Just cross the bridge and
come
to Flushing
Meadows. Hard. It sounds like I'm working harder than you guys. I'm having fun out in Queens.
No, well, we're working really hard. We had a commute. It was really tough to get
speaking
here.
Speaking of working really hard, somebody who's joining us on his day off is Joel Weber.
Afternoon off.
Oh, it's a partial day.
It's a partial day.
It's a partial.
Well, now that you're here, I don't think you're taking the afternoon
Work in
off.
The morning, you know, then I'll go to the Open.
He's the editor of Bloomberg Business. He's with us on site here at the U.S. Open. And if you're watching on YouTube, you'll notice a young man, Henry, is joining us as well. He's 7 years old. He's Joel's son. And, you know, I've heard a lot about him, so it's really nice, Henry, to meet you in person. It's good to have you here. Katie, you were missing so much by not being here. We're going to get to your story right now, though, and talk all about it. It's in the current issue of Bloomberg Business Week. Joel, it starts with Cathie Wood, because something kind of interesting happened with a new Cathie Wood fund. She had to close it up after a few months of operating.
Yeah, and a really memorable comment about lipstick on a pig, and which I think, you know, gets into this whole ESG thing, which we wanted to have in the magazine in the finance section. And Katie had the wise idea to talk about ESG funds. And it's really, there's been so much hype in this space, but performance is an issue, especially this year. What's going on, Katie?
So the problem with ESG, and there's several, but to focus specifically on performance, if you think about what makes up the typical ESG portfolio, it's a lot of technology. And it's not a lot of energy stocks, for example. And if you think about what's done well this year, it's energy with technology at the bottom of the pile. So that is already probably a huge problem for ESG, because just 3% of the U.S. listed ESG stock funds have positive returns in 2022. Just 3%. If you compare that to the overall universe of stock ETFs, it's 9%. So that huge underperformance, that's probably the biggest problem, because if you think about any asset class, any flavor of investing, flows follow performance.
Okay, so the flows. What's happening on the flow front?
So if you look this year, ESG ETFs have taken in about $4.5 billion, which is not nothing, and it's important to say that. But if you compare that to the last 2 years, in 2021, that number was $36 billion. If you compare that to 2020, it was $32 billion. So again, not nothing, but if you look at the actual chart, flows have just fallen off a cliff. And of course, again, putting this in the broader context of what's happening in markets right now, there's been a massive drawdown, and it just feels like people have shifted to, okay, I need to just hold on to my shirt here versus I'm going to invest along my values.
Katie, I can't help but feel if we were still in, I don't know, technically a bull market, if we were still in a bull market and these funds were still returning, that would we be having this conversation? You and I talked about this when you were, you know, subbing in for Tim. I feel like maybe not. Is it all about performance, and that's why we're all getting kind of a little bit crazy?
So there's a lot of sort of philosophical, existential questions about ESG, but when it comes to performance specifically, I think that's a huge part of the conversation. And I've made this point, I feel like, many times, but if you think about the last 2 years in markets, it feels like you could throw a dart at anywhere in the equity market and you would have made money. And that was really to the benefit of ESG, because people got really comfortable. They got used to making money. They started to think a little bit about what I wanted to do with my money beyond just making more money. And that really fueled a boom into ESG in particular. But again, think about where we are now. You have just this long rolling bear market, it feels like. And you have a Federal Reserve that's pretty determined to kill inflation, even if it comes at the cost of economic growth. That all adds up to a pretty bad picture for ESG, especially with that very heavy technology weighting.
But also all of this, Katie, comes against a backdrop of regulators in Europe trying to figure out what exactly ESG is. And investors here in the U.S. As well.
It's a big umbrella.
It is a huge umbrella, and I think that's part of the challenge, and I think some would say that's part of the problem, because it includes a lot of companies that people wouldn't necessarily say are ESG-friendly companies. Take us into that conversation and sort of how that's the backdrop here, Katie.
It is so big and so important when you think about some of the very high-profile greenwashing allegations, for example, against DWS. That definitely sort of took the bloom off the rose a little bit. That happened just in May. And then if you think about, like you said, in Europe, you have regulators taking a closer look, in the U.S. as well. And actually in Europe, you had Morningstar, which is not a regulator, but Morningstar actually stripped the ESG label from almost a quarter of funds that were claiming to promote sustainability. So it feels like investors are maybe taking a bit more of a skeptical look at ESG, just putting ESG on a fund. Well, maybe the last 2 years, that would have been a nice little asset boost, or just another sort of advertisement for the fund. It almost feels as if people are being a little bit more discerning now. And I actually spoke to Ben Johnson from Morningstar. He's the head of client solutions over there. He made the point that my ESG, it's not your ESG. It's an inherently subjective, personal sort of thing. And it's really hard to capture that in something as broad-reaching as environmental, social, and governance. That is an absolutely huge label, and it's hard to appeal specifically to people's own nuances.
Okay, so ESG had a moment, seems like maybe headwinds all of a sudden. Worth mentioning that there are some just straight-up anti-ESG funds that are actually performing well, right? So what do those look like?
So I love this side of the story, but it's important to note that even though with this outperformance and a fund we talk about all the time, the ticker is MAGA. It's the Point Bridge GOP stock tracker. It invests in companies.
I think that was trending on Twitter
today. I've heard that before.
Yeah, you might be familiar with it. So this ETF, it invests in companies that support the Republican Party. It's down about 3% so far this year, but you compare that to the S&P 500, which is down 16%. That is a huge outperformance, but this fund has just struggled to attract any sort of assets. I believe it's under $20 million overall, even though it has, it's been in the market for several years now. So it feels like on both sides of the ideological spectrum here, ESG and then the MAGA ETF, people aren't really investing along their principles right now at this moment in markets when it's really, again, just about preserving capital.
You know, it's what's interesting there too, Katie, is there's been this hesitance among investors to ever really put their politics, money behind their politics, right? And so we'll see if that changes. And obviously, you know, in places like Florida with Ron DeSantis being very anti-ESG, there's going to be a bigger story here that will evolve over time.
Yeah, I mean,
time.
Look what's happened with Disney and Ron DeSantis. Like, yeah, he's not afraid to get involved.
10 seconds, what are you hoping to do at the Open,
you know,
Henry,
should we go get one of those big tennis balls that bounces around? Would you like that? Yeah? Okay.
Yeah. All right,
we'll go get one of those.
All right, our thanks to Bloomberg News Senior Markets Reporter Katie Greifeld and Bloomberg Business Week Editor Jill Weber, also with us, and Henry Weber, our special correspondent here on Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, you are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week live from the U.S. Open. So in the run-up to the U.S. Open, a story came to our attention about how tennis players can be coached from the stands here at the Open. It's a new thing, and in the past, it has caused some tensions between players and their coaches and tournament officials. So we wanted to get into this. So lucky for us, with us right now is Jake Garner, U.S. Open assistant referee. He is here with us on site in Flushing Meadows. Great to have you here with us.
Thank you for having me.
So this is new. Give us some history, because we were reading a bunch of articles about this kind of leading up. And back in 2018, many might remember Serena Williams getting ticked off when chair umpire Carlos Ramos issued a warning for allegedly getting hand signals from her coach that she did. It was against the rules at this time. She was docked a point. Later a game, she smashed her racket. I mean, there's a lot that went on. So give us an idea. I mean, first of all, was this happening beforehand, kind of on the sly, or what?
Well, you say it's new here. It's new for the main draw. We've actually tried to trial this in the qualifying and the junior events as far back as 2017.
Okay.
We, as the U.S. Open, really wanted this to become a rule, but we weren't going to go out on our own without the consensus of the tours, the other Grand Slams. So once the ATP came on board this year to have a trial, that's when we opened the doors to be in the main draw.
ATP meaning?
The men's tour.
Okay.
So it's new that it's in the main draw here. Yes, in the past, it was happening. It was happening from some of the coaches off court. It was difficult sometimes for chair umpires to manage. But it's not new that we're trying it here at the U.S. Open to allow this off-court coaching.
You know, it reminds me. So I played tennis growing up in the 1990s in
Did
California.
Your coach from the sidelines?
Well, you weren't allowed to do that
in
juniors.
Okay.
Yeah. But then I get to college and I start playing college tennis. Yeah. And in college, you're not only allowed to, you're encouraged to, and you essentially are able to meet with your coach during changeovers. Yeah. I always saw that as, you know, that being part of the collegiate experience, the idea of learning. Is there any history with what happens in college athletics with what's happening now? Because that game is a big surprise to me.
I mean, I'm not sure it's specific to college, but I think, you know, of the people, if you bring up this topic of allowing it or not, you have people on both sides. Tennis is an individual sport. It's up to the people on the court to figure it out. All the coaching should be done before or after. And then you have the people who may come from a college background or at least take that mindset that, you know, the person that's off court is seeing what's going on. They should have the ability to give that information right away and potentially impact the match and allow for something to happen in the different outcome.
Hey, Carol, just to answer your question, it's the overbearing parents in Southern California when you're a junior who are doing the coaching from, you know.
Like soccer, like
oh my, it's,
Little League.
It's unbelievable.
No,
parents. Jake knows what I'm talking
parents
about.
Parents getting in the way. Well, Jake, you know, we've talked a lot here at the U.S. Open about the Serena impact, whether it's on the attendance, the prices of things, and so on and so forth. Was there kind of a Serena impact because of what happened in 2018? Because she's so well known in this sport that maybe made it become kind of more accepting, certainly here?
Yeah, I mean, I would say for this specific rule, not really, because like I said, we were trying to trial it earlier
anyway
than this situation. And then that was back in 2018. We've had a couple of years since then. It was really more about getting everybody on board with how we can approach this rule. And
globally getting everybody on board?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, both tours are now on board. The women's tour and the men's tour are trialing it in a similar fashion.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, some on-court coaching was allowed with the women's game. They've changed to this off-court format, so it's really getting it in, you know, like I said, a global impact that everybody's doing it sort of the same way. But, you know, the specific impact of that incident doesn't really, you know, change how we approached it here.
What is so interesting is there have been these incremental changes.
I was going to say, what do you want to ask, Tennis Boy?
No, you can tell I'm like camping at the bit here. But, you know, there have been these incremental changes that I wonder where the motivation comes from. Is it from making it more engaging from a fan perspective? And I think of stuff like, okay, being able to actually challenge a line call or playing a let. I mean, you couldn't play a let at a serve years ago. That was, you know, you would reserve that.
Yeah, I mean, some of it is fan engagement. Some of it's, you know, people thinking what's best for the game, you know, for the players that are currently playing the top of the game. It's sort of like the debate we talked about. Some would agree with the rule and some wouldn't, as why the rule is good. Some will think it's fan engagement. You know, you can see the interaction with the players and the coaches. Sometimes you can hear it on TV. Sometimes, you know, that's a good thing. But I think more than anything, it's just trying to improve the game as much as you can. And if you can allow the players to be at their best, that's
right.
Best for everyone.
Why not? It happens in a lot of other sports. Yeah. I think of, you know, whether it's basketball, you know, pick your sport where, right, the coaches
Correct. Are
kind of screaming from the sidelines.
Absolutely.
We just got a couple of minutes left here. What's it like to be a ref at the U.S. Open?
Well, this is the first year that I'm in this role. So I used to be the chief umpire, so still in the officiating realm. But so it's new. It's interesting. I'm a little more involved with the scheduling of the matches.
What's it like to be on the court, though, with the players,
well,
and especially,
you know,
when things get heated?
So that goes back for me, you know, a few years. It was great. You know, I was the chair umpire until about 2018, and, you know, it's pretty amazing to be out there for some of these matches.
You must love tennis.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how do you stay neutral? You must have a favorite player. I'm not going to ask you.
No,
I will not put you on the spot.
No, it's funny. I don't.
You don't stay neutral, or you don't have a favorite player?
No, I don't have a favorite player.
But is there somebody who's been out on the court, and you're just like, man, am I lucky that I am front row seat, really front row seat on this?
For me, the luck has come in the moments more than the players. You know, I'm lucky to have umpired Grand Slam singles finals. You know, but it's the moments, and whether or not it's the players involved or not, it's more the moments, and that's where the luck comes from.
You think they're more nervous, or you're more nervous before the Grand Slam final?
It's probably both. It's different. You know, they come in with a different set of nerves.
But you're the center of attention at some point.
Absolutely.
We
try to stay out of it, but sometimes it happens.
It was fun watching Serena and Venus play last night in the doubles.
Sure.
But I think about how technology has made it possible, like when there's some questionable, you know, that you can go right to a shot right on. That has helped in a big way.
Oh, absolutely. The technology has changed the game completely.
And the, you know, any kind of controversy about a call or something.
Yeah.
When we went off air, you're like, how did you do this?
I got to tell you, whenever I see, you know, folks like you on TV doing what you're doing, I'm thinking to myself, how do you get to be a professional referee?
Tim's like, how can I do this as my next career?
How did you get into it?
I started officiating at local events when I was in high school. I was 15.
Wow.
I saw a flyer at the local club to attend a training. You know, I joke I got into it for the money. You know, I was a high school kid, and there were college matches, and for me, that $50 a day or whatever was big money.
You're a 15-year-old telling a 19-year-old that's like 6'4".
Well, Yeah,
well, that shot is out, but they think it's in.
Look, that's how I started, or that's how it meant to start. But at the end, it wasn't really well accepted with the college kids.
Right.
You know, the dynamic didn't work.
Yeah.
So I was then doing junior tournaments. It worked a little bit better with some adult tournaments. We had a low-level pro event that came through town as well that I called lines at. And really, I just fell into it. When I graduated high school, I thought I would do it for a year. I started traveling more. I really thought I'd treat it like a gap year. And, you know, this year is my 26th U.S. Open. So,
do you have we just have about 30 seconds. Sure. Do you have a favorite moment, favorite match?
There's too many to count. Like I said before, you know, sometimes I live for, or what I experience are the moments,
yeah,
or the what I remember most is I've been lucky enough to have some family at some of my Grand Slam finals, you know, and so to be able to share that with them, especially my parents and then my wife and kids, you know, to be able to kind of share that with them, it's the same as the players, you know, they put a lot into getting me there. So
it makes sense, considering we just had the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber, and his son Henry was here as well. Like, there is something about being able to share all of
Absolutely.
This with family. Jake, thank you so much. Jake Garner joining us here on site at the U.S. Open. He's U.S. Open assistant referee. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, our next guest has gone from professional tennis player to coach to commentator. She's now helping the next generation get there as well. We are delighted to welcome Katrina Adams.
She's former president, chairman, and CEO of the U.S. Tennis Association. She's currently an analyst for many tennis commentating channels, and she co-hosts CBS Sports Network as well. She's executive director of HJTEP, the Harlem Junior Tennis and Education Program. It's a not-for-profit organization for inner-city kids to learn the game of tennis. How are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
I'm great. Are you kidding? This is like the
how
coolest thing. That, yeah, this is
hey,
the coolest
the US
thing
Open.
I can do.
Of course. Pretty amazing.
I got to say, though, how much more relaxed are you now that you're former president, chairman, and CEO of the USTA?
Oh, I'm so relaxed. I mean, I don't have any of the responsibilities
you
anymore.
Are like,
so
you
I can
look relaxed, okay?
I can come. I can dress more casually. I can walk around and meet friends.
Maybe enjoy some tennis, actually?
Enjoy it. Sit down and actually watch the tennis and enjoy it. But it's such a treat to be able to come back year after year, and I'm enjoying the tennis this year.
Katrina, we have, you know, we've often broadcast here pre-pandemic and stuff, and one of the conversations we had kind of regularly was about thinking about the next generation of tennis players. Tell us a little bit about your background and maybe how that shapes about how you want to help maybe others today.
Yeah, I mean, I started playing tennis when I was six in the city parks of Chicago, Garfield Park on the west side, through a local program, and was able to progress through the sport. I had a coach of that program thought I had potential, took me on, and I started to navigate the sport, you know, playing locally, sectionally, and then ultimately nationally. And I grew up in a program that was really an NJTL pilot program back in Chicago, mm-hmm. Youth Action. And now I run one here in New York. So, you know, it's all about the grassroots. If we have to build a base mm-hmm. in order to get some champions to come out in the future, and that's about growing and developing the sport of tennis.
Is that base bigger than it was in the 1980s when you were going through it?
Well, you know what? I think I started in what they called the baby boom back then. Tennis was so popular in the U.S., but I would say the base has become more diverse since when I was playing in the 70s, and that's a testament to players like Venus and Serena Williams, mm-hmm. And then, of course, Sloan and Madison and Taylor and now Coco.
Is it actually more accessible, though? Has it become more accessible?
Absolutely. I mean, there are programs in all over the country. When I talk about the NJTL, the National Junior Tennis and Learning Network, there are over 200 chapters nationwide. The USTA Foundation funds many of these programs, whether it's financial or just with human resources and helping them to develop and grow. But there are also so many other community tennis programs around the cities, in the city parks, as well as in some of the clubs as well. And so the kids' interest, you know, when you look at tennis and how it's evolved over the years, and it's a lot more colorful, a lot more excitement in the sport. You look at a Nick Kyrgios, and he's actually drawing players into the sport because they think it's cool,
yeah.
Right? And that's what we need. We need personalities.
He has a personality.
He has a personality, but, you know, Serena has a personality too. And, you know, you look at the queen and the greatest of all time and what she has accomplished in her career and the number of athletes that she has attracted to the sport, boys
yeah.
and girls alike. I think it's phenomenal.
I just wish Nick wasn't so shy. No, but was
I know we need to work on him being more expressive.
You know, I'd written some notes here because I was reading your background and you know how you grew up right the West Side of Chicago, youngest of three, only girl, and there was a story. I guess it was Sports Illustrated. Growing up in the 1980s when gangs were on the rise, that was their words. I hate that I'm going to ask this. You know, how did you do it? Because I feel like, you know, we are a diverse society. But we're still asking that question because many of the industries in our world are not as diverse as they should be and need to be. So, you know, how do we get there? It sounds like programs like you're doing, but how do we even get more diversity in a sport like tennis?
Well, I think we've done a great job, we meaning the USTA over the years, in becoming more accessible through programs like the NJTL chapters. We have adaptive programs as well. You know, we're a huge supporter of the LGBTQ plus community. And so,
like last night was great. Like
absolutely, Pride Night was last night with HBCU Live the night before. So, when people turn on the television, they can see themselves in our sport. And
right.
It says, "Wow, they're accepting." You know, I want to try that sport. I want to find out more about it. How do I get more involved? And so, we've definitely done a tremendous job over the last 20 years, I would say, in opening up and being more open. Well, be open is a hashtag.
Was it hard
be open.
When you started?
I won't say it was hard when I started because when I started, I grew up in a community program. You know, I had coaches that loved me. I joined a program in the wintertime. I joined another program. I started playing ATA Nationals. I tell people that I didn't know that tennis wasn't a black sport until 2 years in because the programs in the tournaments I was playing, there were so many black tennis players that were good and competitive. And so until I came into the USTA system in the late 70s.
Was that tougher?
I don't want to say it was tougher. It was just that because I was good enough to start playing or wanted to continue, that it was more challenging because I was the only one that I would see at these tournaments.
Yeah.
But it became a cost-effective matter for a lot of the kids that I started playing tennis with.
Katrina, just 20 seconds left. The state of the U.S. tennis program when the Williams sisters are on their way out.
It's awesome. The USTA Player Development Program has done a phenomenal job of being more diverse, as we're talking about that, be more inclusive, making sure that these kids have a pathway to develop, to be the champions they want to be, and hopefully be a champion right here on Arthur Ashe Stadium.
Oh, man, I wish we had longer. Katrina Adams, thank you so much. Good luck with all your efforts.
Thank you very much.
Let us know how it's going in the program. We'd love to keep in touch. Executive Director of HJTEP, the Harlem Junior Tennis and Education Program. But as we said, man, she just does a lot and understands this game from so many different angles. Katrina, thank you.
Thank
really
you.
Appreciate it. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, Tim Stenovek, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
You know, Tim, yesterday we talked about how inflation has taken a bite out of attending this year's U.S. Open. It's costing you more. You know, that honey deuce, it's pretty pricey.
Is college costing more? I'm asking somebody who just dropped her daughter off at college, just out of curiosity, is college costing more?
As I gulp, yes. what's interesting, though, is one of the conversations that my daughter and I have had as she heads back to school is about, you know, the food, the fine dining halls of academia.
Well, okay, you say that you're like you're laughing, but as I said yesterday, the food at my college was too good.
You were lucky.
Yeah, it was too good. And interestingly enough, Janet Lauren, our higher education finance reporter for Bloomberg News, she's with us on site here at the U.S. Open. She's got a new story out about how dining halls are adapting menus to gird against food inflation. So what's going on at colleges that you spoke to?
Well, you think about when these tuition, room, and board prices are announced early in the year, like February and March, and now they're getting everything ready for the new year, and it's up 11%. So they're trying to figure out how they can adjust their budgets since they're not increasing the costs for families. You're going to see, you may not see as many hamburgers, but you may see beef stew with vegetables, so it's not going to be the main star
it's
of
like
the menu.
It's like leftover night.
Sloppy Joe's.
Yale is decreasing the amount on their salad bar. And another thing that they've been concerned about for quite a while is food waste. Kids will come back several times, and they're not eating it, and then they throw it away. And it's not good for their budgets. It's not good for the environment, and they've been long trying to stem that issue.
I love that. I want to get into that, but I always feel like it's like a separate sweet issue that they're worried about that. Go back to the cost, because part of the problem is, and I didn't think about this, and you put it in your story, Janet, is that, I mean, they set the price, they send it out, they do it, and then all of a sudden, like, it's inflation and food's going to cost more. I mean, they've got to deal with it and figure out ways to deal with those higher prices of costs, and some of it has to do with what? Like reducing variety and so on.
Reducing variety.
Or offering stew.
reducing portions, too, again, because of food waste. And something else that they've been moving towards that students seem to really want is more plant-based options. Sodexo, which
but that's
does,
not always cheap, is it?
Well, if you're not talking about Impossible Burgers, they're doing the stuff from scratch. You know, maybe they're offering more lentils, more tofu, because students are interested in that.
Well, that's what's so interesting. It's like they're kind of tapping into something that is already happening right now, and this idea of moving more toward plant-based. But at the same time, it's better for the environment,
right?
And it's less expensive.
It's less expensive. And Sodexo, which does 500 campuses across the U.S., gave out menus last month with a plant-based alternative.
They did mine, by the way,
for Monday.
Did they?
I remember, yeah. I mean, I'm 38, so yeah.
What I find interesting is the tofu thing. There was tons of tofu in my college cafeteria.
Probably wasn't like it is today.
Sign of the times.
It was kind of... It wasn't,
right?
It wasn't sweet. I didn't love it.
Was it the special vegan dining hall or something?
No.
You guys didn't have that.
No, I know. It was just kind of slid in. So that's kind of interesting. Are they going to ultimately, though, Janet, I think about this. So does this mean next semester or next year, they're going to probably, if we still see these inflationary pressures, it's going to be more expensive again? Or will they continue to do this?
Well, they're still
strategy?
Kind of constrained. I mean, if you were offered a 10% increase in college tuition, that would be a little bit untenable, especially with we're mm-hmm. talking about some of this. Yale is the second richest private college in America. So there's only so much that they can increase. And,
right.
You know, maybe they're spending more from their $42 billion endowment. But we know endowment returns are going to be down this year, as we've talked about anyway.
Well, the year's not over.
Well, their fiscal year is over.
Okay, all right. Okay,
but it's you know, it's not an easy time in higher ed.
What? Nope.
Hey, before we let Janet go, it's kind of a bittersweet day because it's last official. Well, you're like not even officially still, you know. We're not supposed to be making you work. But you have some really exciting news to share. Starting now, you are back at Columbia University, your alma mater. You're a Spencer Fellow for the next academic year. Tell us what that entails.
So it's a program designed to allow reporters who write about education to dig into a deep subject. And I've been writing about historically black colleges on and off for the last couple of years. And this is a chance to dig into a certain subset of public HBCUs in the South and look at their finances. And we'll see what comes out of that.
Oh, my gosh, which is such an important topic right now. You know, we were just talking with Katrina Adams about diversity in tennis, and she's working with kids in the Harlem area and more, and just really trying to create some more diversity among a younger generation into the sport. But it sounds like, you know, when we look at academia, the importance of those institutions, right, in giving them the opportunities that everybody else has.
And it's following the money or the lack of money for a long time.
Yeah.
But you'll be back in
I'll be back June. next in a year.
Okay.
So next Open,
yes,
be back
I'll
with
be
us.
Back here.
She'll be back here. She'll be back at Bloomberg. I mean, she's not leaving Bloomberg. She's just taking a break at Columbia. Well, we look forward to the fruits of your efforts. Good luck.
Great.
Stay in
Thank
touch.
You. It's been a great almost 15 years here.
I know. You're not going anywhere, though.
No, I'll be back.
Janet Lauren, she is higher education finance reporter at Bloomberg News. Her stories have always been among the most read on the Bloomberg.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive, say you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just about 9.5 minutes left in today's trading session. It is time for the Drive to the Close, and David Dietz is back with us, Managing Principal, Senior Portfolio Strategist at PPAC Private Wealth Management, roughly $9.5 billion in assets under management, on site with us at the U.S. Open, which has become a bit of a tradition, a really nice tradition. Welcome back.
Well, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be back, and of course, everything is different now. It's all about Serena this year. At first, we thought it was going to be her, you know, legacy tour, and now she actually might win it. How exciting can that be?
See, and here I was
going to... What did you think?
No, I'm like, okay, is David going to talk about the tournament first, or is he going to talk about the markets first?
This is David's day off. It's so nice of all the people who are off today to come by and, like, spend time with us.
Are you getting lots of calls, though, from the office? Like, what the heck's going on here? We had a rally. Everybody was Goldilocks jobs report, and now the market's going to look like it's going to close off its worst levels.
Absolutely. I'm at the U.S. Open. The market is up after... that Goldilocks jobs report, and all of a sudden things start to tail off. And now instead of watching Andy Murray, I'm thinking, what is the catalyst? What's going on here? A couple things I would say. One is there is this belief out there that you don't want to be in the market ahead of the three-day weekend. And I'm thinking, my investors, I train them to do one, three, 5 years.
You know, Creedy said this to us, Carol, earlier.
I know, but it's 3 days.
Exactly.
The longest the market's ever closed.
What is going to really change unless... I don't know.
The only thing I can think of is those poor United Nations monitors are there at that nuclear power plant in Ukraine.
And that's rough.
Tensions are up with China, of course, after the United States government is limiting exports by NVIDIA and other chip companies in terms of AI. So there are geopolitical tensions.
That's so interesting that you talk about the geopolitical tensions more so than the strength of the U.S. economy or perhaps, you know, what the Fed has to do in response to the strength of the U.S. economy, given what we heard from the Labor Department earlier.
Well, I think the latter is so key because I thought we did get a great report here where we're still creating more than 200,000 jobs. It had a three handle. And, of course, what's nice is that wages were a little bit more muted because more people are coming into the labor force. That's what we want. We want a little more supply side so that Powell and company don't have to work just on the demand side. But the fact of the matter is three-quarters hike later on this month is still on the table.
Yeah.
That's not off. Now, the chances have diminished a little bit. We're going to know a lot more, Carol and Tim, September 13th when we get that final CPI figure going into that meeting.
What did I say? It's like a kid jumping across stones in a brook. This is what the Fed is doing from report to report. We got one down today.
Jobs to CPI.
And the next one is like the next inflation print.
The only other catalyst I saw today was that durable goods order from July. Everyone expected up 10 basis points. It was down 1%. First down month in a string of up months.
Yeah.
So that reminds people, okay, the economy is cooling, and right now our last message is from the Federal Reserve officials is we're hiking and we're hiking hard. And that might not work out so well.
Well, okay. I know you shared with our producer, Paul Brennan, a couple of names that you like. So are you more buying for your clients, more selling, or more sitting pat?
Well, we're sitting pat with our asset allocations, and quite frankly...
Do they change that much?
We tell people, don't change your asset allocation based on the headlines or what you hear on Bloomberg, unfortunately. Change them if something personal to your family and your goals have changed.
Okay.
Or as you get older.
Something internal to you.
So if somebody's got some new money to commit and... their situation's good, would you say, you know what, let's just wait. Let's leave it in some cash, something very liquid right now. I don't really want to put it to work. Would you put it to work?
Well, you know, I kind of like putting it to work here from a client, you know, safety perspective, maybe a little dollar cost averaging. But here, we're down 18% from the beginning of January. Interest rates are still low. You're not going to get anywhere where the 3.2% on that 10-year. Mm-hmm. And I do think we're closer to the end, the Federal Reserve rate hikes, than we're at the beginning. They've front-loaded a lot of rate hikes. So I say, put your money to work, go against the tide, and we have a couple names that we really like.
All right, let's talk about some of these names. D.R. Horton is one of them.
That's a tricky one because, so here, the macro theme, of course, is we don't have enough roofs in this country, right?
Yeah.
And so the people, the younger generations want to get out and have their own house and so forth. Everyone wants new when it comes to construction. So D.R. Horton's one of the market leaders, increased their earnings 22% a year for the last 5 years. They should earn $16 a share this year, but the stock has a $70 handle. So it's cheap, cheap, cheap.
Okay, so you don't really worry about the macro fundamentals too much.
It's good.
Because these names, yeah, exactly. These names move big time
but
on
look,
the
macro. We need a lot of, I mean, I'm not trying to answer for you, David, but just plain devil's advocate here. We need housing in this country.
Yeah.
Also, I'm buying 40% less than, let's say, last November. So a lot of the bad news is discounted, and if things really get tough, some of the smaller players are going to fall by the wayside where the market leaders will continue.
All right. J.P. Morgan.
J.P. Morgan, one of the few Dow components that's up today. Why? All the bank stocks are down 30 to 40% this year. This was supposed to be their year because of higher interest rates, but that yield curve got inverted.
Right.
But again, I go to the cream of the crop there, Jamie Dimon, the dean of financial institutions and so forth.
You know, they're building a new headquarters. You know, every time a company...
Their name's all over the stadiums here.
And every time a company builds a new headquarters, it's always like,
Yeah, but I would not want to compete.
Not scientific. I'm just saying I've noticed from years of reporting.
So here's the thing. It's about 10 times earnings. It's just, yeah, the price to book, they're priced like an average bank, but they're an above-average institution. And I want to capture that differential. Things get tough. Stick with J.P. Morgan.
All right,
I just had a big picture question.
Go.
You know, I'm reading Eric Balchunas's book from Bloomberg Intelligence. It's called The Bogle Effect. It's about Vanguard and the rise of Jack Bogle. And it's got me thinking, has it gotten harder to compete with the indexes and just, you know, potential clients, instead of putting their money with you, they're putting their money in an S&P 500 index fund?
Are your clients really index kind of people?
Well, look, you know, I love Jack Bogle's quote, every dollar you don't pay on fees is a dollar to your bottom line.
Yeah.
So I'm with him in terms of keeping your investment fees down. On the other hand, we like to be just a little bit more creative than sprinkling our money based on market cap weighting. Because when you think about it, when the market cap goes up and the S&P allocates more to that name, the prices are up. And when it comes back down, that's when you want to be accentuating the ones that come back down.
So creative meaning what? Stock picking, private equity, real estate?
All of the above is good.
You got high net worth folks.
All of the above is good, but you know, if you're talking people up to $20 million, that stock market looks pretty good because you have instant liquidity, you have small fees.
Still?
Absolutely. Hey, so we're trading at, 18 times earnings? That's about a 6.5% earnings yield versus what? And, of course, historically, over the next 10 years, those earnings are going to go up 5 to 10%. Dividends are going to follow that. So 10 years from now, even with the market 18 times earnings, I think you're going to do well.
Look, the crowd agrees with you. No, they agree with who's ever playing over there. Just going to put it out there. David Dietz, thank you so much. A pleasure.
A pleasure. Thank you. Good to see you guys.
Enjoy the open. Of course, Managing Principal and Senior Portfolio Strategist at PPAC Private Wealth Management. This is Bloomberg.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.